This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 6th of April 2016 on Monocle 24.
Tonight, are reports of Donald Trump's demise greatly exaggerated again? Why has fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh stopped, and why did it start? And could it be Mammon, which finally chases God out of American politics? Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Wisconsin enjoys a rare bask in the global media spotlight. My guests Mary Dajewski and James Boyes will assess the results of the state's Republican and Democratic primaries. We'll also be discussing other stories from across the United States and looking at the mercifully brief thawing of a frozen conflict in the Caucasus. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are James Boyes, the political historian and author, most recently of Hillary Rising, and Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian. Welcome both. The good news, first of all, is that there's bad news for Donald Trump. The bad news is that it's good news for Ted Cruz. The junior senator from Texas won a convincing victory over the game show host from New York in yesterday's Republican primary in Wisconsin, somewhat lengthening the odds on a Trump nomination and shortening the price on a contested convention in Cleveland in July. In the Democratic primary in the same state, Bernie Sanders outpointed Hillary Clinton for all the ultimate difference it's likely to make. Mary, first of all, is this at last the frequently and frequently erroneously predicted Donald Trump flameout?
Well, in many ways you'd like to think that it was, and it appears to have at least one very identifiable cause, because he really wrong-footed himself on the subject of abortion, and he probably lost the whole of the female vote in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is actually it's an interesting state because it's one. It is a classic swing state. It's possibly, though James will know better than me, second only to Florida in terms of its sort of balance. I remember being there in 2000, and the interesting thing was that sort of 2 weeks before the election in 2000, you could sit in Wisconsin and every single senior candidate would come through Wisconsin. You didn't have to go anywhere. The candidates came to the state because they were so desperate to win it.
But to follow that up just briefly, Mary, he has been boorish and horrible and oafish and discourteous towards and about women before now. It seems to have been playing quite well for him.
Well, it plays well with a certain section of the population, but Wisconsin it's in the north of the United States. It's not in the deep south, which is where at least some of his remarks tend to go down better. And abortion is, again, it's one of these touchstone issues, and there'll be much more support for it in the north than there will be in the deep south. So he made his remarks at a particularly bad time if he wanted to win Wisconsin.
James, why were those remarks by Donald Trump about abortion so damaging? Because myself, I've been backwards and forwards through Donald Trump's views on the subject four or five times, and I have absolutely no idea what he thinks.
Well, let me build on Mary's point there. I would go further and say that when he's made criticisms about women before, to a greater or lesser extent, they've been about specific women. So there was an attack upon Cruz's wife, for example, a specific individual, upon Megyn Kelly,
from Fox News.
The very, very classic example. What he did this week was attack all women who may or may not want to have or need an abortion.
And
very, very different situation, and talked about criminalising them.
And that's an extremely large electorate, obviously.
Very much so. Now, you rightly point out, he's been all over the map on abortion at all points of his career, because, of course, he has been a Republican, he's been a Democrat, he's been an independent. Who knows what he'll be next week? But one thing we hope he won't be is President of the United States.
Is there, just to follow that point up, though, James, is it possible that another aspect underpinning Cruz's defeat of him in Wisconsin is a growing understanding among Republican voters that Donald Trump cannot win a general election?
I think one of the things to remember about where we're at with the Republican race is that Trump has benefited massively from the vast range of candidates who've been in the race so far. The fact that they have all, to a greater extent now, dropped out is going to help, actually, Cruz, because if you look at the polling figures that Trump has received, they haven't moved very, very much, considering that so many of the people have dropped out. The suggestion was always that he was hitting somewhere between 35 and 40% as a ceiling, and that hasn't really changed an awful lot. He's still only getting that level. His numbers haven't necessarily gone up very much. Cruz's have, which is noticeable enough. And the remainder, obviously, is sticking at this point, in Wisconsin at least, with Kasich. So we are certainly at an interesting point, but we certainly can't start writing off Trump at this point, mainly because of where the race goes next, which is to New York and the Eastern Seaboard, where he will, I think, do well.
Mary, if it is to be a choice between Trump and Cruz as the Republican nominee, it's just a thought I wanted to put out there, which has been expressed by a few, you know, cheese-eating liberal American friends of mine, that they would actually prefer Donald Trump on the grounds that at least he doesn't believe anything he says, whereas Ted Cruz just might.
Well, you do sort of look at the pair of them and you think, God save America, really, because I tend to agree with you. I think in a choice between Ted Cruz and Trump, then I would go for Trump, because I think he might actually think about being president. And even though he doesn't have the political experience, you look at Ted Cruz, you look at him campaigning, and personally, I'm absolutely terrified in a way that I'm not of Donald Trump, because he has all the sort of preacher man, all the vocabulary and the manner and the demagoguery that people accuse Trump of having. But I think with Cruz, it's serious.
One of the things that's interesting at this point and that differentiates the two campaigns is that the Trump campaign is all based around Donald Trump. It's ego-driven, it's individual-driven, it's not team-driven. With Cruz, whatever one makes of his politics, and I certainly would not agree with them, what you see is a far better ground game. So Trump has been complaining very strongly this last 2 weeks or so about how unfair the rules are, the fact that he has won some states and not won the majority of the delegates. That's mainly because of the fact that Cruz is a far better organized candidate. He's a former attorney. He's got a lot of lawyers working for him. Elections in the states are an awful lot, we remember 2000, about litigation and making sure that you know how the rules are played. Trump is complaining about the rules. Cruz is playing by the rules, and that's going to help him moving forward towards the delegation count.
Just before we talk briefly about Hillary Clinton, I did want to ask both of you if you've got a smart outsider tip for a Republican nominee. If a contested convention occurs, which means potentially anybody could have a crack at it, is there anybody other than the front runners who you think's worth a $10 bet on as a potential Republican nominee? Mary, first of all?
Well, I'd probably reluctantly go for Kasich, because although he's incredibly boring and although his opponents at any contested convention can say, well, actually, he got so roundly beaten by the other two that he doesn't really warrant any sort of Democratic credentials. He does come across as reasonably sane and sensible, somebody who could be a credit to the United States outside America. And he was also backed, interestingly, very early on, I think, when the New York Times chose a candidate. So I think I would probably go for Kasich.
You got a £5 or $10 bet, James?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to steer away from anybody who's put the hat in the ring so far on the basis that I'm reminded of 1960 when the party elders watched Jack Kennedy run around the country trying to win the early primaries that were going on, believing that Kennedy couldn't win on the first round of the ballot, and at that point, the Senate Majority Leader at that point, Lyndon Johnson, would unwillingly, but in the sake of good party unity, put his hat in the ring. That was Johnson's race to the presidency in 1960 all down. And I think at the moment, the person who would stand best to gain in that situation would be Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan trading at about 18 or 20 to 1. Could be worth a few bob. Final very brief thought from you on this one, James, on the subject of your latest book, Hillary Clinton. She got handsomely thumped in Wisconsin by Bernie Sanders. Does that dent her at all, really?
Psychologically, it's not great, but in terms of delegate counts, the last time I saw, because it's a proportional representation system, Bernie Sanders won about 41, 42 delegates. She won about 30, 31 delegates. She is now far further ahead in the delegate count than Obama was 8 years ago. She only needs to win moderately, i.e. a small majority in New York, New Jersey, California and Pennsylvania to get the majority of the delegates that she needs of the four states of the 21 left to vote.
Okay, well, let's move on now to Nagorno-Karabakh, where a ceasefire... that was no audible grinding of gears there at all. Nagorno-Karabakh, where a ceasefire has been agreed after 4 days of skirmishing between Armenian and Azeri troops. If history is any guide, however, this won't be the last time that fighting over the disputed enclave starts or stops. The war of the early 1990s, in which tens of thousands of people died, has never quite ended. Mary, the thing that has struck me about this particular outbreak is that no one really seems to have a clear idea of who started it or why. There's even some suggestions coming from both sides that it might have been a bit of a mishap or an accident. Somebody took a pot shot at somebody, somebody else quite reasonably got upset by this, and here we all are.
Yes, I mean, it seems to be a grand mess. And like you, I haven't read any decent account that gives any authoritative version of what might have happened or why it suddenly flared up. Because Nagorno-Karabakh is the sort of, it's in some ways the original frozen conflict. This is the one that in a way defines all the other post-Soviet miniature conflicts.
You're talking about conflicts like Georgia, Ukraine, etc.
Those are big conflicts. What I'm talking about are things like Transnistria and Moldova and the two mini enclaves in Georgia, which the Russians sort of left themselves in charge of after going into Georgia. These are the sort of mini conflicts that people are talking about, maybe eastern Ukraine becoming a similar mini conflict. But Nagorno-Karabakh has been there all along. And in some ways, it was the sort of... it was the harbinger of the breakup of the Soviet Union, because it all erupted as the Soviet Union was breaking up, and it's never been resolved.
And just to follow that up, though, Mary, the Turkish Prime Minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, made fairly ostentatious noises about standing shoulder to shoulder with Azerbaijan while this conflict, such as it was enduring in the last few days. To what extent is there an aspect here of a proxy war between Turkey and Russia? Turkey obviously being big friends with Azerbaijan, Russia being big friends with Armenia, neither of the two huge countries liking each other very much.
Well, it is possible to see it like that, but I wouldn't see it like that, because I think one of the interesting things about this, and one of the things that makes it in a way different from many of the other frozen conflicts, is that Russia really is on both sides. Russia has
been selling weapons to both sides.
And apparently it's been selling weapons more expensively to Azerbaijan on the grounds that it's a sort of petro economy, it can afford them. And it uses uses some of the profit to subsidize the sales to Armenia.
The cynicism of which is breathtaking. It is kind of funny up until the point that, you know, actual people are getting killed by said cynicism. James, is there... I mean, this must be one of those things that you know, every time it drifts across John Kerry's desk or whoever the Secretary of State has been for the last 30 years, they've just looked the other way, taken a holiday, tried to punt it to the office down the hall, etc. Is there anything America can or should say or do about this one?
It's very difficult to actually figure out what that would be. When you look at where this reached...
Other than please stop, obviously.
Please stop, obviously, yeah. That might work, actually. When you look at where this region is and you consider issues of sphere of influence, you've got to ask... Since you asked me specifically about the American interest, where is the U.S. interest in this? It's very, very difficult to say. I appreciate that there is a petrochemical element to all this, but when it comes down to issues of U.S. National interest, far too often, let's remember, the United States gets criticized for intervening in areas where its national interest is questionable at best and disputed at worst. So clearly there is no U.S. national interest in intervening at this point. It's an area where, of course, you, as you rightly refer to, you know, we want to see the fighting stop and peace be imposed effectively. But in light of the cynicism that's clearly coming out of the Kremlin with regard to the arming of both sides, with the idea that there is a lack of political will to get this shut down anytime soon, it's very, very difficult to see how any American administration, least of all one which, let's not forget, has been focused for the duration of its time in office in withdrawing from questionable engagements around the world and not going around looking to find dragons to slay, and certainly not looking to get engaged in new military conflicts, least of all potentially with, dare I say, Russia. It's very, very difficult to see how it is that in the timing that's remaining to Barack Obama, he or his Secretary of State are going to do anything progressive or meaningful in this case.
Mary, the other thing that struck me about this conflict, or has struck me about it a few times as and when it's come up, is that, you know, Nagorno-Karabakh is it's an enclave carved out of a bit of Azerbaijan. And for all that, as we've been discussing, Russia is selling weapons to both sides, my back of a beer mat calculations suggest that if Azerbaijan was really determined to have Nagorno-Karabakh back and devil take the consequences, they probably could. What is stopping Azerbaijan from doing that? Is it just a concern about how Russia might react?
I think it's more that it's worried about getting involved in a much bigger conflict. And at the moment, it doesn't have any guarantee that Russia would not intervene on Armenia's side. I mean, I don't think that Russia would intervene on either side. And I think one of the biggest reasons why this conflict is still simmering away is because it's really not of huge importance to anybody else. There is nobody else who has a gigantic, you know, it's not just America, there's nobody else, including the Russians, who has any great interest in having this resolved or having it continued. It's simply immaterial to too many people. And so I think that's the main reason why it's continuing.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Mary Dzhevsky and James Boyce. Coming up next, Mississippi's governor hauls his state boldly into the 19th century.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are James Boyce and Mary Dzhevsky. Now, back in 1931, let it not be said I don't do my research, the American Mercury, then under the editorship of H.L. Mencken, ran a three-part series determined to establish once and for all the identity of the worst state in the Union. The prize was awarded to Mississippi, and they did not anticipate controversy. 9 out of 10 Americans, they decided, would probably nominate Mississippi as the most backward. Governor Phil Bryant has done little to contradict this conclusion this week, signing a law which permits businesses to refuse service to same-sex couples on, and I think we can probably put fairly hefty inverted commas around this, religious grounds. James, if we're going to try and be charitable towards Governor Bryant, is there any way at all we can look at this other than as bigotry dressed up as faith?
Difficult to see how, really, isn't it? The topic of much of my work is Bill Clinton, who, of course, comes from Arkansas, which is hardly the most progressive state in the Union. And a regular retort heard in Arkansas was, thank God for Mississippi, because it used to constantly just about make sure that Mississippi...
Another essay by Mencken made exactly that point, in
there
fact.
We are.
It is quite celebrated battering of Arkansas.
Absolutely. With perhaps good reason, on the basis that, at least, thank goodness for Mississippi, Arkansas wasn't bottom of every league table measurable. When you look at this this news coming out today, it's particularly depressing because one of the things that we're not talking about this time around with regard to the Republican Party and its general candidacy is a sense of homophobia, which has in the past, to be honest, permeated a good deal of the discussion at the top level of the party. It wasn't that long ago when W was president, of course, that there were widespread calls for constitutional amendments to make marriage strictly between a man and a woman. Now, that didn't get anywhere. It didn't even get out to the states. It certainly didn't get to Congress. But the fact that that was being discussed not that long ago, I think, is a clear sign of the fact that nationally the battle has been won. There is now no dispute necessarily amongst senior members of the Republican Party with regard to issues of gay marriage. So the fact that this has come out now, I think, will actually be a great embarrassment to those members of the Republican Party who really want to put this issue, dare I say it, to bed, and move on beyond it and be seen as being more progressive. So people like Paul Ryan, I think, will be actually horrified by this in his attempts to try to quell this side of the party. And of course, it's just it's a very, very easy and all too obvious stick to beat the party with as being backward and regressive, which is exactly what this measure is.
We should, of course, note that there has been a huge objection to this within the state of Mississippi and again across the South as well as the United States. The South being, ironically, and possibly exactly because of nonsense like this, you know, the heartland of many of the United States' greatest liberal champions, you know, Martin Luther King, Jimmy Carter, Huey Long, you know, it is also a region of contradictions. But one of the things that appears to be changing, Mary, is that a lot of the objections to this stuff now are coming from big business, which has become rather more socially liberal. In response to similar laws in North Carolina recently, we've seen PayPal announcing that it was cancelling a $3.6 million investment in the state. We've seen, you know, a few other Mississippi employers, Nissan and Toyota, saying they're not happy about this. Might that be the thing that actually changes it? Is it likely to be commerce that eventually advances progress?
Well, it's certainly one of the things. And of course, the American system so fosters that because politicians depend so much on money. And so, you know, somebody like the governor of Mississippi or the governor of North Carolina is going to find themselves in a very difficult position because on the one hand, they need the money. And on the other hand, they need, if they're Republicans, they need a certain section of their base. And there is going to be a conflict about this for a while. But I would like to go back to something just in the past as we were talking about George W. Bush. You could almost actually date the change in the Republican Party's official stance on this, because when George Bush became president, Dick Cheney became his vice president. And Dick Cheney has two daughters, one of whom was out and gay. And interestingly, she spans this divide between, or at least with industry, because at the time she was working as a sort of equality officer and PR person for Coors Brewery. And that really, it completely annihilated any suggestion of any sort of homophobia from the White House. And it also allowed people with gay relatives to be much softer on the question, much more humane than had happened in the past.
Again, James, just to try and see this from Governor Bryant's point of view, he's trying to claim it as a First Amendment question, saying it protects expression of religious faith. Is that any kind of argument? Again, I've tried. I'm not sure I can see it.
Yeah, hopefully my quizzical expression is betraying my inner thinking as well on this. Yeah, fair enough. And what you would say is that the population of that fine state can turn around and exercise their First Amendment right to vocalise their opposition to this. Industry can exercise its rights by deciding not to do business in Mississippi. And I think that you'll start to see that. And, you know, and what's tragic about it is if ever there's a state that needs inward investment, that needs companies coming to it to invest in the state and bring employment and development to it, it's Mississippi. And if this piece of legislation, if this approach to social policy causes a reversal of that, then it's all to the detriment of the state. And one would imagine that the population will eventually vote accordingly and turf this guy out of office, hopefully.
But isn't that, and just a final thought from you on this, James, isn't this basically been the Republican strategy pretty much since Nixon, that you persuade poor white people to vote against their own economic interests on the basis of fairly spurious values issues?
Well, the Southern strategy that you're rightly alluding to is certainly something that the Republican Party have made an awful lot of mileage out of. And the great concern, obviously, is that you see Donald Trump using very, very similar language this time around, even using the silent majority concept that Nixon spoke of in 68. The extent to which that works has clearly been demonstrated. The question now is are we going to see a repeat of that? I think that you're going to see, hopefully, come November, a repudiation of Donald Trump. And And certainly if you look at a lot of the polling that's coming out of, say, for example, University of Virginia's Center for Politics, then you'd think you'd have to be quite optimistic about that.
Okay, well, finally tonight, and staying in the United States, if the previous story was about one of the least important things an office holder can do, i.e. pandering to the meanest instincts of his constituents, this one is about one of the most important, i.e. ensuring that clean water comes out of the taps. Incredibly, this is not necessarily a long-term given in New York, where Mayor Bill de Blasio has postponed work to finish a much-delayed third water tunnel, which is seen as vital to the city's future water security. Mary, the tunnel as it currently exists, the third one, is supplying Manhattan and the Bronx, not yet Brooklyn and Queens. There's two other tunnels which do that, both of which are very, very old. The incredible thing about this third tunnel is that its construction was first authorised in 1954. Construction started in 1970. They still don't know when it will finish. Has the world figured out a way to actually get big infrastructure projects, especially important ones, done without turning into China?
Or you might say France, which also seems quite successful at these things.
Well, indeed so.
But I think there is, there's obviously several issues here, that something as big and expensive as that is very tempting to put on hold if you need money for what you think, as a politician or mayor of New York, you think are more urgent questions that need to be addressed. But I also think that, I have to say, I was horrified. The first time I went to the United States and went to the Northeast, including New York City, I was completely horrified. This was sort of 40 odd years ago, by the state across the country of American infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Because I'd gone there expecting this country to be sort of state of the art as it presents itself. And in the private domain, of course, it is in every respect. In the public domain, not just in New York City, but in a lot of other major American cities and in rural areas, the infrastructure is a disgrace.
A thought that I think still occurs to anybody attempting to enter or leave via JFK Airport, absolutely. Which is a perennially bewildering experience. James, what is the reason for that? Is it just that thing that the trouble is with long-term projects, important though a lot of them are, by the time they're actually, you know, it's not going to be you that cuts the ribbon, is it, if you're the mayor who's in now?
Yeah, you know, when I was thinking about this story and you were talking about it, I was thinking, I'm sure that this is the same tunnel system that's at the heart of Die Hard with a Vengeance that comes out in 1995, and it was being under construction then, and I'm quite sure that it was, quite frankly. You're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more with Mary's point with regard to this. You know, the United States presents itself as this gleaming state of the art in the nation, and yet the infrastructure upon which it prides itself, much of which was put in the 1950s under Eisenhower, has not been updated. The lack of inward investment in the country is shocking. And it's, you know, coming back to one of my my areas of research. Bill Clinton in 1993 attempted to introduce this idea of investment spending, of investment in infrastructure, couldn't get it through Congress. Nobody wants to spend the money on the country. Everybody's quite happy to spend it on defense and military equipment. Nobody wants to spend it on the infrastructure. And the country is falling apart and becoming a joke as a result of that.
Mary, de Blasio has claimed that he's punting this because he's trying to spare New Yorkers, many of whom do struggle to pay their bills, further rate hikes. Water bills and sewage bills went up annually 8% under Bloomberg, which is a colossal raise every year. Is that an argument?
Well, it is an argument, and it will be a very convincing argument until such time as Brooklyn finds itself without any water.
Which I mean, that is the weird thing, is like these self-set traps politicians set for themselves. Because if that does happen on your watch, that's obviously career-ending, isn't it?
Absolutely. Nobody, you ask, why does this happen? Nobody wants to raise taxes to spend on these projects, which, as you say, are going to be a generation down the line. And nobody concerned is saying, I was the man who did this. I took responsibility for it, because they'll be out of office donkey's years before it comes to the opening.
On that happy thought, that is all we have time for on today's instalment of Midori House. James Boys and Mary Dejewski, thank you both very much. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Charlie Young and Maria Granina. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music up next. 1900 Hours, Danny Giacopelli is in with the Entrepreneurs. The Daily follows him after a couple hours more music at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'll also be your host for that. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.